Omar Barghouti is a dynamic Palestinian public intellectual and activist who respects people enough to engage and challenge us. As a member of the group that Abby mentioned, KUWU, and personally, I want to thank him for coming here and speaking with us tonight. Omar is an electrical engineer and dance choreographer, but many of us will know him best as an independent political analyst whose writings have been published in Counterpunch, Al-Haram Weekly, ZNet, Electronic Intifada, just to name a few. Some of us had the privilege to meet with him earlier today and enjoy in person the unembellished lucidity that we have come to expect from his writing. Most germane, perhaps, to Israeli Apartheid Week are Omar's experiences as a founding member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, or PACB. His lecture tonight is entitled Apartheid Israel, Democracy as an Existential Threat. Omar, it is a tremendous honor to be able to welcome you here. Thank you very much for coming. And please join me, everyone, in giving a very warm welcome to Mr. Omar Barghouti.
Mahmoud Darwish, Palestine's greatest poet, once wrote, "Dead blacksmiths awaken from their graves to make our shackles. But we never dreamt of more than a life like life and of dying our own way. But when life like life becomes too much to dream of and dying is often dictated by the oppressor, humanity as such is essentially defied. Resistance then becomes a survival necessity, not just a moral duty. While Jerusalem is being subjected today to one of the worst Israeli campaigns of gradual ethnic cleansing, Gaza remains as the test of our common humanity and our indispensable morality. A thorough analysis of the role played by Western governments, including the Canadian government, in regards to Israel's war of aggression against Gaza will demonstrate a resounding failure on both accounts. Throughout the atrocious assault, the official West was a willing accomplice in Israel's grave violations of international law and basic human rights. If not critically examined and reversed, this unethical and irresponsible policy may usher in a new era of aggravated injustice and uncontainable instability and violence for years to come. From the onset, it's crucial to emphasize that a fundamental principle that informs my analysis is my categorical and morally consistent opposition to racism and all forms of racial discrimination on the basis of ethnic, national, religious, gender, or sexual identity, and this includes opposition to Islamophobia and antisemitism. I view equality, freedom, and dignity as indispensable rights that every human being should enjoy, irrespective of his or her identity. In words that can quite accurately be used to describe Israel today, Robert Kagan, a leading American neoconservative ideologue, justifies hegemonic tendencies as a prerogative of the mightiest, saying, "The United States remains mired in history, exercising power in the anarchic Hobbesian world." We continue. Worse things could happen. "The United States remains mired in history, exercising power in the anarchic Hobbesian world where international law and rules are unreliable and where true security and the defense and promotion of a liberal order still depend on the possession and use of military might." End of quote. True to this paradigm, Israel has for decades maintained a regime of occupation, colonization, and apartheid over the indigenous people of Palestine through the possession and use of military might. In addition to the indispensable collusion of Western powers, whose largesse in academic, cultural, economic, and political support has for six decades enabled Israel to maintain and develop its multifaceted system of colonial oppression against the Palestinians. By contributing to Israel's blockade of Gaza and the criminal war against it, Canada, the EU, and other Western states have reached a qualitatively different stage of complicity. becoming more blatantly than ever full partners in the US-Israeli policy of undermining the rule of law and espousing in its stead the law of the jungle. Inadvertently promoting the Bush bin Laden self-fulfilling prophecy of a dichotomous world divided surgically into good and evil, with each side regarding the other as evil. In response to this fatal alliance of savage capitalism in the West with Israeli racism, exclusion, and colonial subjugation, the global movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, against Israel presents not only a sophisticated, sustainable, and effective form of resistance that is nonviolent, but a real chance of becoming the political catalyst and moral anchor, as South Africa was at one day, for a strengthened, reinvigorated international social movement capable of reaffirming the rights of humans to freedom, equality, and dignity, and the right of nations to self-determination. Gaza. As early as 2007, Professor Richard Folk of Princeton University, and currently the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, called the Western-supported Israeli siege of Gaza, quote, a prelude to genocide. Later, he called it a Holocaust in the making. Folk, who happens to be Jewish, argued that the siege is especially disturbing because it vividly expresses, quote, a deliberate intention on the part of Israel and its allies to subject an entire human community to life-endangering conditions of utmost cruelty, end of quote. Using more diplomatic language, Professor Sarah Roy of Harvard University, an expert on development in the occupied territories, accuses the EU, along with the US, of complicity in a deliberate Israeli policy of what she calls de-development of the occupied territories, killing any possibility of creating an independent and sovereign Palestinian state. By providing the Palestinians with tangible benefits, such as higher income and improved infrastructure, Roy argues, the EU was hoping to buy Palestinian support for substantial concessions in the so-called peace negotiations. She concludes, the logic of international law was abandoned in the interest of maintaining a failed political process. An examination of the Israeli siege of Gaza, most of whose population are refugees forcibly displaced by Zionists and later by Israel during the 1948 Nakba, can elucidate this de-development policy, which amounts to collective punishment in international law. During this ongoing 18-month-old siege, 80%, that's 80%, of the 1.5 million Palestinians caged into the world's largest open-air prison have been pushed into poverty and dependency on international humanitarian assistance. The entire economic infrastructure in Gaza has been systematically decimated, with more than 95% of factories forced to shut down, driving poverty and unemployment below sub-Saharan African standards. Educational institutions have been unable to function properly due to lack of fuel and electricity for prolonged periods. The health system is on the verge of complete collapse, and indeed hundreds of patients have died because of lack of medical support and not being able to access medical facilities outside Gaza. The longer-term effects of the siege, however, are really the most daunting point that I want to bring up. According to the World Health Organization, chronic malnutrition and dietary-related diseases have alarmingly increased, resulting in rampant low birth weights, anemia in more than two-thirds of all children in Gaza under the 1 year, and stunted growth in 13.2% of children under five. Moreover, preventable diseases caused by polluted water and inadequate sewage processing started spreading widely. Thousands, mainly children, have suffered serious hearing problems due to Israel's once concentrated use of sonic booms. These are very loud noises made by F-16 jets for weeks on end. A whole generation of Palestinian children in Gaza will suffer severe developmental and psychological disorders for many years to come, health studies have shown. There's also a significant increase already in the rate of incidence of cancer and other deadly diseases directly related to Israeli-inflicted pollution and healthcare denial. For the record, Canada was the first country in the West to support the boycott of the democratically elected Palestinian government in 2006, which eventually led to this genocidal blockade of Gaza. Reacting to the devastating impact of Israel's siege, Karen Abu Zaid, the Commissioner General of the UN Relief and Works Agency, warned, quote, "Gaza is on the threshold of becoming the first territory to be intentionally reduced to a state of abject destitution, with the knowledge, acquiescence, and some would say encouragement of the international community," end of quote. In this respect of the siege, this process leading to the slow death of masses of people, and to inhibiting the development of an entire generation of Palestinian children, this is the process that prompted Professor Folk's eye-opening description of Israel's siege as constituting acts of genocide. But even years before that, in 2003, former Israeli education minister and leftist leader Sholamit Aloni condemned an Israeli atrocity that pales in comparison with what Israel has committed in Gaza recently. Aloni said, "So it's not yet genocide of the terrible and unique style of which we were past victims. And as one smart Israeli general told me, we do not have crematoria and gas chambers. Is anything less than that consistent with Jewish ethics? Did he ever hear how an entire people said that it did not know what was done in its name?" End of quote. And that was all before the bloody attack on Gaza. On the opening day of its assault on Gaza, the Israeli military caused massive destruction of civilian infrastructure and massacred close to 200 Palestinian civilians, many of whom were non-combatant civilian police trainees, while no Israeli civilians were reportedly killed on that day. Still, Lawrence Cannon, your foreign minister, issued a statement expressing deep concern about, quote, "the loss of life and the suffering sustained by all sides." He was quick to add, quote, "Israel has a clear right to defend itself against the continued rocket attacks by Palestinian militant groups which have deliberately targeted civilians." Leading international jurists, however, disagree with your foreign minister. They categorically rejected Israel's self-defense argument in ads in the Times of London, among others, accusing Israel of committing war crimes. The UN Human Rights Council, as well as the UN Secretary General, have both called for impartial, independent war crimes investigations. Canada, of course, was the only country that voted against the Human Rights Council decision to investigate Israeli war crimes. Even the EU abstained. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the Israeli organization B'Tselem, and many other international human rights organizations have all called for investigating what they viewed as Israel's war crimes, refuting the self-defense claim that Israel has put out, particularly because the June 2008 ceasefire between Israel and Hamas was first violated by Israel on November 4th, as is widely recognized now, when it attacked and killed 6 resistance fighters without any provocation or pretext. Gerald Kaufman, a senior Jewish Labour Party member of the British Parliament, compared some Israeli actions to those of Nazis. So did Noam Chomsky. And Holocaust survivor and senior academic Hayo Meyer of a different Jewish voice in the Netherlands. Echoing Kaufman, Chomsky, and Meyer, prominent Jewish British intellectuals and academics compared Gaza to the Warsaw Ghetto in a letter published in The Guardian. Gaza aside, it's important to remember Israel's other forms of colonial and apartheid oppression. Palestinian civil society and a growing number of influential human rights advocates recognize that Israel's regime over the indigenous people of Palestine constitutes occupation, colonization, and apartheid. Specifically, Israel's decades-old oppression takes 3 basic forms. The prolonged occupation and colonization of Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and other Arab territories. 2, the system of racial discrimination against Palestinian citizens of Israel, and I'll talk a lot about this point. And three, the persistent denial of the UN-sanctioned rights of Palestinian refugees, paramount among which is the right to reparations and to return to their homes of origin in accordance with UN Resolution 194. Ending these three forms of oppression is the minimal requirement to achieve a just peace in our region. The most important of these three injustices is, without doubt, Israel's denial of the right of Palestinian refugees to return. The core of the question of Palestine has always been the plight of the refugees who were ethnically cleansed during the Nakba and ever since. The fact that refugees form a majority of the Palestinian people, coupled with their 60-year-old suffering in exile, makes the recognition of the basic rights of Palestinian refugees, including the right to return, the litmus test of morality for anyone suggesting a just and enduring solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Moral and legal rights aside, the denial of Palestinian refugee rights guarantees the perpetuation of conflict. So even pragmatically, it does not make sense. As to the occupation, nothing quite captures its immense injustice as much as Israel's colonial wall. Despite the wall's grave repercussions on Palestinian livelihood, environment, and political rights, a near total consensus exists among Israeli Jews in its support. The former Israeli Environment Minister, Yodit Naot, however, protested a specific aspect of the wall, saying, quote, "The separation fence severs the continuity of open areas and is harmful to the landscape, the flora and fauna, the ecological corridors, and the drainage of the creeks. The protective system will irreversibly affect the land resource and create enclaves of communities, animal communities that is, that are cut off from their surroundings," end of quote. Even after irises were moved and passages for small animals were created in the wall, so her concerns were accommodated, the spokesperson for the Israel Nature and National Parks Protection Authority was not satisfied. He said, "The animals don't know that there is now a border. They are used to a certain living space, and what we are concerned about is that their genetic diversity will be affected, because different population groups of animals will not be able to mate and reproduce. Isolating the populations on two sides of a fence definitely creates a genetic problem." End of quote. This is the harshest we've heard in the Israeli mainstream against the wall. While so attuned to the welfare of wildflowers and rabbits, Israel treated Palestinian children as dispensable creatures. Professionally trained sharpshooters fatally targeted Palestinian children in minor stone-throwing incidences, as the late Professor Tanya Reinhardt of Tel Aviv University has documented. Medical sources and human rights organizations, including the Israeli Physicians for Human Rights, have also documented in the first stage of the current intifada a pattern of targeting the eyes and knees of Palestinian children with a clear intention to harm. And when there was no stone-throwing incident to hide behind, Israeli soldiers had to provoke one. The veteran American journalist Chris Hedges exposed how Israeli troops, before their redeployment out of Gaza, had methodically provoked Palestinian children playing in the dunes of Rafah in the south of Gaza in order to shoot them, concluding, quote, "Children have been shot in other conflicts I have covered, but I have never before watched soldiers entice children, like mice, into a trap and murder them for sport." Israel's repressive and racist policies in the 1967 occupied Palestinian territory have been recognized as constituting apartheid by a host of opinion leaders, as Archbishop Desmond Tutu, former President Jimmy Carter of the U.S., and former UN Special Rapporteur Professor John Dugard, among others. Even Israeli Attorney General Michael Ben-Yair wrote in 2002 in Haaretz, describing Israel's regime in the occupied Palestinian territory, the following: "We enthusiastically chose to become a colonial society, ignoring international treaties, expropriating lands, transferring settlers from Israel to the occupied territories, engaging in theft, and finding justification for all these activities. In effect, we established an apartheid regime in the occupied territories. So Israeli Apartheid Week did not invent the term. However, the applicability of the crime of apartheid, as defined in UN conventions, to Israel itself, has for the most part been either inadvertently glossed over or intentionally ignored as an explosive subject that has every potential to invite the vengeful wrath of a very powerful Israel lobby. Regardless, one cannot but examine the facts and analyze Israel's system of governance accordingly. The strongest argument given by well-meaning experts who dismiss the apartheid label for Israel is that the analogy between Israel and South Africa is not exact. And in many respects, Israel's oppression is in fact worse. The problem with this argument is that it assumes, quite inaccurately, that apartheid is a South African trademark. And therefore, every regime accused of practicing apartheid must be shown to be identical to South Africa's flavor of apartheid. Apartheid, although brought to world attention and given its name by the racist regime in South Africa, has been recognized by the United Nations for decades as a generalized crime with a universal definition and clear criteria. So we have to study the criteria and see if it fits Israel or not. Scientifically, that's the only thing we can do. As a recent in-depth strategic position paper published by the Palestinian BDS National Committee states, Israel's origins, laws, and policies against the Palestinian people basically fit the definition of apartheid, and I'll show you why. The conceptual origins of Israel's unique form of apartheid are found in Zionism, a racist ideology of the late 19th century European colonialism, which was adopted by the mainstream of the Zionist movement, the World Zionist Organization, the Jewish Agency, the Jewish National Fund, and so on, in order to justify and recruit political support for its colonial project in Palestine, creating an exclusive Jewish state. Political Zionists dismissed the indigenous population of Palestine as non-existent in the infamous Zionist slogan, "A land without a people." To make this a self-fulfilling prophecy, they indeed forcibly displaced 750 to 900,000 Palestinians to make room for the incoming settlers. Israel's regime over the Palestinian people amounts to apartheid precisely because it displays many of the main features of the crime of apartheid as defined in international conventions. One, racial discrimination against the indigenous Palestinian people who became citizens of the State of Israel was formalized and institutionalized through the creation by law of a Jewish nationality, which is distinct from Israeli citizenship. No Israeli nationality exists in Israel. It's not recognized by the government, by parliament, or by the Supreme Court. There's only Jewish nationality, but Israeli citizenship. And rights are, you're entitled to rights according to your nationality, not so much your citizenship. The 1950 Law of Return, for example, entitles all Jews and only Jews to the rights of nationals, namely the right to enter Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, including the occupied territories, and immediately enjoy full legal and political rights. Jewish nationality under the Law of Return is extraterritorial, in contravention of international public law. It includes Jewish citizens of other countries, like Canada, irrespective of whether they wish to be part of the collective of Jewish nationals, and it excludes non-Jews, i.e. the Palestinian indigenous population. Two, the 1952 citizenship law in Israel was passed in order to regulate the acquisition of Israeli citizenship by Jews and non-Jews. This legal framework has created a discriminatory two-tier legal system whereby Jews hold nationality and citizenship, while the remaining indigenous Palestinian citizens hold only citizenship. Under Israeli law, the status of Jewish nationality is accompanied with first-class rights and benefits, which are not granted to non-Jews. Three, the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights in 1998 noted with grave concern that, quote, the Israeli status law of 1952 authorizes the World Zionist Organization, Jewish Agency, and its subsidiaries, including the Jewish National Fund, to control most of the land of Israel, since these institutions are chartered to benefit Jews exclusively, end of quote. The committee expressed the view that large-scale and systematic confiscation of Palestinian land and property by the State of Israel and the transfer of that property to these agencies constitute an institutionalized form of discrimination, a very important condition of the crime of apartheid. Four, and last in this section, return of Palestinian refugees and internally displaced persons has been prevented by means of force and racist legislation in Israel. Simply because they're not Jews, Palestinian refugees were excluded from entitlement to citizenship in the State of Israel under the citizenship law. They were denationalized and turned into stateless refugees in violation of the law of state succession. Land and other property belonging to these refugees was confiscated by the State of Israel, and approximately 500 depopulated villages were destroyed in an operation termed Cleaning the Landscape, which continued until 1960. People think it ended in 1948. It did not. The approximately 150,000 Palestinians who later became citizens of Israel were placed under a military regime from 1948 to 1966. For decades, then, racial discrimination against Palestinian citizens of Israel in every vital aspect of life has been the norm, not the exception. From land ownership to education to health to jobs to housing, the indigenous Palestinians have been denied equality by the state's laws and policies. For instance, Palestinian citizens of Israel are not allowed to buy or rent on 93% of the land of Israel. 93% of the land is purely for the benefit of Jews and only Jews. To this date, polls have consistently shown overwhelming majorities of Israeli Jews standing in opposition to full equality with the indigenous Palestinians in the state. So the fact that Palestinians in Israel can vote, unlike their black South African counterparts under apartheid, becomes almost a formality, a tokenism of sorts, clearly designed to project a deceptive image of democracy and fend off well-justified accusations of apartheid. Even in cancer research, and I want to just give this one example, in cancer research, Israeli apartheid is strongly present. In June 2001, the Health Ministry in Israel published a map of the geographical distribution of malignant diseases in Israel during the years 1984 to 1999. The report did not include a single Arab community in Israel, with the exception of Rahat, a Bedouin town in the Naqab, ostensibly due to budgetary problems. This research is particularly important in Israel because only when there's a correlation shown between the presence of polluting sites and the incidence of malignant diseases is it possible to prevent installation of new hazards or to demand tighter environmental controls. By intentionally omitting Arab towns in its extensive cancer mapping, the health ministry has indirectly given a green light to polluters to relocate to Palestinian towns inside Israel, not to mention the occupied territories, of course, which is a dump for Israeli industries. The results of such health apartheid are ominous. In the past 3 decades, the rate of malignant diseases in the Palestinian population in Israel has risen at 3 to 4 times higher than among the Jewish population. A spokesperson for the Israeli Center Against Racism commented on this report, saying, "The report has produced 2 different groups. One, an overprivileged group whose lives are dear to the state and to the health ministry, and a second whose lives are of no importance to the state." End of quote. This discrimination must be seen in the wider context of the perception of Palestinians in Israel as a demographic threat, no less, by mainstream intellectuals, academics, politicians, artists, and so on. And as a demographic threat, it needs to be dealt with resolutely. Thus, the rise of openly fascist parties in the current parliamentary elections in Israel. Echoing a popular view, a ranking academic, Major General Shlomo Gazit, from the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies, preached years ago, Democracy has to be subordinated to demography. And now Lieberman and his supporters are saying democracy has to be subordinated to loyalty to Jewish supremacy. The complicity of Western governments in all this horrific violation of international law and basic human rights has become blatant. They have not only failed to comply with their legal obligations to end Israel's occupation and other forms of oppression, but have for decades been generously providing Israel with economic, financial, academic, cultural, and diplomatic support, treating it effectively as above the law of nations. This grave complicity has led many analysts to view the role of the West as profoundly flawed, both morally and legally. Like every other people aspiring to live in peace and justice, we shall not surrender our inalienable rights, our right to self-determination, to freedom, to equality, and to human rights. We cannot but resist oppression and hold on to our dream of justice and dignified living. Thus, BDS. Since July 2005, boycott, divestment, and sanctions have been advocated by virtually the entire Palestinian civil society, and I'm coming to the end here, as a form of solidarity that has a real potential to bring about an end to Western complicity with Israel, and therefore to Israel's occupation, colonization, and apartheid. During and ever since Israel's criminal war on Gaza, Palestinian civil society stood united in urging people of conscience all over the world to hold Israel accountable for its crimes by treating it as South Africa was treated under apartheid. In response, unions, academic groups, faith-based organizations, political parties, social movements, and others have adopted creative, context-sensitive, and sustainable BDS campaigns from South Africa to Norway, from Australia to Canada, and even from the podium of the President of the UN General Assembly. Israel's state terrorism in Gaza, enabled by support from the US and Western governments, was a key catalyst in spreading and deepening BDS around the world, prompting advocates of just peace in Palestine to feel that our South Africa moment has arrived. Israel is now widely viewed as a pariah state at the grassroots level that commits war crimes with impunity and that needs to be held accountable to international law and basic principles of human rights. This last February alone witnessed some of the most significant indicators to date of this phenomenon of the growth of BDS. In Ontario, as you know, the Canadian Union of Public Employees endorsed a boycott of Israeli academic institutions. In Durban, South Africa, the COSATU-affiliated Dock Workers Union refused, for the first time in history, to offload an Israeli cargo ship, reminding us all of similar sanctions taken against South African apartheid in Denmark in 1963 and later in other places. In the US, Hampshire College, which was the first to divest from South African apartheid, was the first to divest from six companies invested in the occupation, Israeli occupation. In Wales, just a few days ago, just before I came to Canada, Cardiff University acceded to demands by students and decided to divest from companies supporting the Israeli occupation. Even in France, where it was one of the most difficult challenges for the BDS movement, uphill struggle for years, a statement was recently issued by leading academics explicitly endorsing BDS to end Israel's impunity. The recently spectacular entrenchment of the BDS campaign gives us hope that one day Israel's impunity and Western, UN, and Arab collusion with it will come to an end, allowing a genuine just peace to flourish in Palestine and the entire region. Only thus can ethical coexistence have a real chance to come true. In his poem, Message to the Living, Henk van Randwijk, a Dutch poet of resistance against the Nazis, wrote, quote, "A people giving in to tyrants will lose more than body and goods. The light will be extinguished." On Saturday, 24 January 2009, 2 days after the end of Israeli hostilities, and despite all the death, devastation, and trauma, hundreds of thousands of Gaza's children, almost literally, rose from under the rubble that most of Gaza was reduced to and went with enthusiasm to their damaged schools, carrying their torn bags, scarred books, and injured souls. Their agony was deep and anger deeper. but their eyes were still shining with defiance, ambition, and hope for emancipation. Do not extinguish their light. Thank you.